very cool Clouds Below Your Knees by Texas Ray Lynch. Signals 8 p.m. Wednesday, and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling and only on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, and alongside a team smothered in talent, Greg Audell, Drs. Warren Holloman and Mary Edgerton, engineer and media maven Nicole Rocherlin, and ace intern Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls before returning us safely to the present. Tonight, Mary's on a journey to attend to her daughter in Denver, and I've got the honor of covering for her. But tonight, well, we got a bit of a mixed bag, sort of, because each story you're going to hear is meant to illustrate a unique feature about storytelling. I guess you could call it an audible workshop. I'll play recordings of some stories, and other yarns will be delivered by one of my favorite tellers, one of those go-to guys who hover around the front door of KPFT begging for another moment on this program. Actually, we beg him. A coveted spot indeed for any and every storyteller wanting to become famous. And hell, he already is, at least around these parts. He's Eric Keen, Montana native, husband, father, former sheep rancher, animal control officer, military policeman. You know, everyone's going to memorize your bio after a while, right? And federal investigator. Eric eventually quit the rat race. Did you race rats too? To pursue a career in writing after being named fanstory.com's Short Works Writer of the Year in 2011. He became a contributing writer for Mensa magazine. He's a member of the Houston Storytellers Guild, has competed in several monthly Moth Story Slam competitions. He's won a couple, and he's qualified for the Grand Slam coming up May 2nd. Congratulations, buddy, but I wish May 2nd was a mistake. We talked about that a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. You know, last year the Grand Slammers had 2 months before the Harvey-induced postponement, and May 2nd is coming up fast, and it's on a Wednesday, and it's finals week. Tatiana is just studying already for her finals, right, Tatiana? At all of these, right, she has no idea, she's saying studying for finals, are we supposed to do that? I didn't know. In any event, any updates on that? Not yet.
Not that I know.
No, nothing at all. Now, the theme is going to be What's Love Got to Do With It with Tina Turner, I guess, as entertainment during permission.
I hope so.
Those people under 45 have no idea what I'm talking about. Do you, Nicole, have any idea what I'm talking about?
Proud Mary, keep on burning.
I'm just checking. But you're no longer a child, so it's understandable.
I'm a young adult. Young adult,
Tatiana,
everybody.
What about
young
you? Adult. Does Tatiana know what I'm talking about? What's Love Got to Do With It? Tina Turner?
Yes, I do. Surprisingly, I do know that song.
I am surprised.
I can't sing. I'm not going to embarrass myself.
I know. Now, how are you going to select a love story, by the way?
Well,
because you got a lot. You're a ladies man, and you're out there, and look at you. I mean, the handsome devil that you are.
Oh, yes.
Your wife is sitting right here. She agrees.
It makes it tough. Yes.
It does. It does make it tough.
Well, I've gone through all my old stories and looked at any story that could fit that theme of the Grand Slam, and they're all goofy. So I'm going to have to come up with something fresh, but I'm pretty sure it'll end up goofy anyway.
Yeah, well, you know what? Your goofy is always fresh. We listen to stories every week at the Moth, the Guild Swaps, and it's astonishing how many features are needed to craft a really good story. You know, you need a protagonist, you need conflict, a setting, theme, motifs, suspense, and so on. What's the most essential feature, Eric, that you need to nail a story? You're a great storyteller, all kidding aside. I think you are. And you do so many things well. But what is that one essential feature that you need in order to say to you, all right, I'm ready to go. I got this.
Well, one central feature I always strive for is curiosity. I think you got to establish curiosity at the outset. Now, in other words, you got to get the reader or the listener to keep asking, how the hell is this going to end up? Just establish that curiosity and build on it until you slam it home with a conclusion.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. I do. And some people underestimate curiosity because they want to know, well, how do I engage my listeners? How do I get them involved? Well, as you said, you've got to get them curious. You have to get them to figure out how this is going to end. Yes. Well, to me, you know, a sense of timing is one of the many things that you do well, and I've given this some thought. Your story about your wife's romance novels that you told at the Guild's concert at Company on Stage is a great case in point. The way that you internalize dialogue, anticipate responses, you know, you create the final product, so to speak, and I think it's masterful. It's like you're having a conversation with yourself, and I find that terribly appealing, but it requires a lot of timing, not unlike a comedian, because your stories are funny. But what inspired a story that was centered around romance novels?
Well, that story came about when I discovered my wife's hidden stash of romance novels, even though she swore she never read those things. And I was looking at the covers on these things, and I'm looking at the men, and I'm thinking, I can compete with those guys. So I tried, but I think I fell a little bit short on it.
Let's hear that story. This is great.
Sure. Well, my wife, she once told me that I should be more romantic. And so I thought about that. And I thought, nah. But one day, this romance issue, it just came to the forefront of our very marriage. It was when Katie, my wife, she went out of town to visit her parents for a week. First day she was gone, I was cleaning some clutter out of our storeroom. And from way in a deep back corner, I uncovered a box full of romance novels. Now, I felt like my wife was cheating on me. It's like she needed these romance fictional heroes to fulfill some needs that I was failing to satisfy. But then I looked at the bright side. There, at my fingertips, lay a treasure trove of forbidden female secrets. And I had an entire week to decode them. Then I could show Katie a real live romance hero. I took this box of romance novels to my living room. And over the next 7 days, whenever I had a chance, I would sit and study these things to try to find out once and for all what it is that women want from men. It's the most baffling week of my life. I pick up the first novel. I'm thumbing through, and I come across this scene where some guy named Magnus swoops this woman named Elizabetha into his arms and spins her around. So I made a note of that. And I practiced this swooping maneuver to use on Kate. I used our basset hound to practice. Now, as I read these things, I began to notice something funny about the dialogue. Now, people haven't spoken like this for like 600 years. Men were using words like cherub and oh, rapturous bliss. So I made a note of that. And I learned this archaic love language. And they'd always, just out of the blue, they'd throw in a little bit of French, like, mon chéri, là, je t'aime, blah, blah, blah. So I learned some French. And then there was the sex. Now, these weren't like novels from the 1920s. These were contemporary. These were lurid. And the men in these books set the bar pretty high. And I noticed they'd never just go right in for it, for the big shebang. I mean, they'd carry on forever with nuzzling and nibbling and caress, forever. In this one book, some fireman named Devlin went on nuzzling and nibbling for 20 pages. So I made a note of that. I practiced this nuzzling and nibbling at nighttime on my pillow. Well, at the end of the week, I was ready to dazzle Katie with my newfound romance skills. Sunday night, I meet her at the door, long-stemmed rose clenched in my teeth. I hand her the rose and I say, "Welcome home, my cherub." I led her into the living room, and I swooped her into my arms. Now, this hurt my back, but the pain made me feel like a martyr for love. So I hobbled over to the sofa. I plopped her down, and I sat next to her. I looked her in the eyes, and I said, Moi, j'ai quitté la douleur, la bleue. She looked at me. I'm getting ready to nuzzle and nibble. And she says, I see you found my romance novels. Right then and there, I gave it up. I gave up the charade. I knew I'll never be a romance hero. I'm just me. I'll never be able to swoop her into my arms like Magnus, speak French like Pierre, or go on in bed for 20 pages like Devlin. But then she scooted up to me. She said, Eric, I wouldn't trade you for all those romance heroes in the world. Oh, rapturous bliss.
Oh, yes, rapturous bliss. Yay! I love that story. You know, I think that male firemen probably have sex more than any group of men on the planet, wouldn't you think?
I think so.
I don't know what it is. I don't know. I'm going to ask your wife. She's right here, but she's taking pictures. I don't want to ruin her concentration. You know, very, very good. Okay, romance novels. Nicole, have you got any romance novels? You found this quite funny.
Yes, I do.
Yes, you do. You read them, don't you?
I do read them.
Yeah, cheap paperbacks. I know.
No, I actually, well, you know what? I did buy the three-part series, the paperbacks.
The three-part series.
Yes.
Did you get the student rate?
No, I didn't. Uh-huh. But 50 Shades of Grey. I read all three of those books in less than 1 week. Uh-huh. I just couldn't put him down.
Gee, what was your favorite part? Never mind.
Honestly, don't ask, because I will tell you.
Is Tatiana being storytelling.
This is storytelling time.
I think it's too early to announce that it's Tatiana's birthday on Friday. All right? Right? Are you going to be 21? You're going to be 21, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Turning 21 on the infamous Friday the 13th.
Well, don't go shopping with Nicole. My God. She will turn you into a lecherous old lady. And unbelievable. Unbelievable. Now, good tellers paint verbal pictures. And along with voice, face, gestures, and eyes, they create methods to transport listeners before returning them safely to the present, which is one of my favorite lines. And Jackie Ford, another one of our favorite tellers, supplies her listeners with what I consider to be a simple landscape dotted with everything she sees and feels along the way. She takes us along, and painting a verbal picture, I think, is what she does so very, very well. Nicole, let's listen to Jackie's story, please.
In the winter of 1978, in January, I was 16 years old, and I went on a journey. I went from my hometown of Springfield, Virginia, up to Exeter, New Hampshire, and an extraordinary place called Phillips Exeter Academy. That Thursday morning in January, a family friend of ours, Stephanie, came to the house to drive me all that long way up to Exeter. And Stephanie was the one doing the drive because my father was ill and my mother needed to stay home and take care of my dad. So Stephanie had volunteered to drive me. And so we left before dawn, went on this long, long trip up the I-95 corridor. And I was excited the whole way because it was an extraordinary opportunity for someone like me to go from a just regular middle-class concrete kind of suburb outside of D.C. to this extraordinary school that was and is one of the top high schools in the country and perhaps even the world. And so as we did this trip about halfway north up I-95, it began to snow. And I thought that was extraordinary and beautiful too. And it was one of those heavier snows where the snow really sticks to the fir trees. And we went through iconic New England town after iconic New England town. And the snow got a little heavier. And I thought it just got prettier and prettier. Of course, Stephanie was a little more concerned. She was sort of white-knuckled on the steering wheel of her Dodge Dart as she plowed through this snow. But eventually, after dark, we did get to Exeter. Snow was still continuing. There's probably about a foot of it on the ground. And I woke up in the morning, and this bright blue sky and this bright sunshine. And during the night, that last bit of snow had some ice mixed into it. And so it just glittered in that sunshine like 1,000 crushed diamonds had been spread into that top layer of snow. And I just thought it was one of the most beautiful things I had ever seen. one of the most beautiful places I had ever been. And I thought, I have come home. This is home. This is the place that I am meant to be. And Stephanie got me into my dorm and kissed me on the forehead and drove away. And I threw myself into that school. It's a long story why I was starting mid-year instead of the fall. But I was so excited to be there. And within a couple of days, it was pretty obvious that I might just be in over my head. You know, the other kids I was at school with were very smart and very knowledgeable, and many of them were way better prepared than I was for this extreme academic burden, and I just felt like I was starting to drown, and I was not doing very well in my classes. And then one day, about 2 weeks in, I got a little English paperback that we had written in class the day before, and I got an A-. And I thought, wow, maybe I'm not an imposter. Maybe I can actually do this. And I felt so good, and I came out of the classroom, and I had a little kick in my step, and Miss Keel was waiting for me outside the classroom. She was a teacher who lived in the dorm with us at boarding school. The faculty live in the dorms. And she said, you need to come back to the apartment with me. Your brother needs to talk to you. And I'm the youngest of five children, and this was my oldest brother who was calling. So I got back to the apartment, and he called, and he said, Daddy's really sick. You need to come home. There's a plane ticket waiting for you at the airport. Miss Keel is going to drive you. You need to pack your bag right away and get home. And that's all he wanted to say about it. Now, I had seen enough melodramatic black and white movies on our little TV at home to know that when someone is called home because of a sick relative, it probably means that that relative is dying. And I knew my dad had cancer, but I certainly didn't think that things could escalate so quickly. But Miss Keel got me to the airport. I got on the plane, and while I sat on the plane, I remembered another thing about those black and white melodramatic movies, and that is that they never want to let the kid go to the hospital. You know, the kid's not supposed to go. So I thought, I have to be prepared for that. So I wrote a little speech, and I memorized it about why I should be allowed to go to the hospital to see my dad. So I got home to the house late that afternoon, and everyone was just sort of standing around drinking coffee, and didn't seem to be a sense of urgency, so I finally said, when can I go see Daddy? And that's when they told me that my father had died the night before. And they hadn't wanted to tell me over the phone, hundreds of miles away, among strangers in all that snow. And a very deep grief took its hold, and it kept its hooks in me for quite a long time. But then a second layer of grief kicked in not too long after, which was, in addition to losing my dad, I was going to have to give up Exeter because someone needed to stay home and kind of keep an eye on my mother for a variety of reasons. And I was really the only one who could do that. And on top of that, I was having my own struggles and really shouldn't be, you know, hundreds of miles away at that time. So I had to withdraw from Exeter. And the next week, I went back to school at the same high school I had left with a big chip on my shoulder just a few weeks earlier. So that was a very tough time. And in the meantime, I tried to adjust to that sense of loss at both ends. And one morning in March, I woke up and I heard this scraping noise outside. And I looked out, and we'd had a big snowstorm, very unusual. And I realized the scraping sound was my mother shoveling the snow. I thought, well, I'm supposed to help my mother, so I got out of bed, I put my coat on, I grab another shovel, I go outside, and she is attacking the snow. She is wailing on that snow. And I said, Mother, good Lord, what are you doing? And she said, this isn't right. And I said, well, I know, we don't usually get snow like this in March. She said, no, I'm not talking about the snow. It's not right. It's not right that your father is not here to do this. And it's not right that you are here. Your dad was so proud of you and so happy for you, so excited for you to be able to go away to school like that. That's where you need to be. You need to go back. And at that point, I couldn't imagine that. But I took several days and I thought about it, and we eventually called the school, and they said, well, you'd have to reapply. So I reapplied, and miraculously, I got in again. And so that August, it wasn't Stephanie, but my mother driving the car up the I-95 corridor. And this time it wasn't snow. It was this beautiful green in all these towns, just verdant and fresh and beautiful. And we got to Exeter, and she moved me into the dorm and kissed me on the forehead and drove away. And that year that I spent there was was something that has stayed with me the rest of my life, and all for the good. And we had a lot of snow that year. We had a second round of blizzards in 1979 to match the ones in 78. But to this day, Exeter is the place that feels most like the place I am meant to be. It feels most like home. And to this day, some of my best friends and the best things in my life are things that I trace back to Exeter. And what I think I learned from that journey, first with Stephanie and then with my mother, is that each of us is looking in our own way for that place that is that best place, that place that we are really meant to be. And at the end of the day, we're all just driving each other home.
Before?
It's the first time I've heard of it.
Oh, what'd you think?
I think it's great. Metaphorical and well-paced, so, and emotional, great.
I loved her ending. You know, there's something very special about being able to tell a story and knowing when you're ending a story rather than saying, I'm done, you know, the end. Mm. And she does that really well. I was looking at some of these great quotations that you gave me, and I appreciate these. And how do you pronounce this gentleman's name, Paulo?
Coelho, I think.
Coelho. And I'm looking at this, and it reads, the power of storytelling is this, to bridge the gaps where everything else has crumbled. Yeah, and I think about that. We'll be talking about arc in a few minutes. The idea is that what happens when a character in a story gets so low, and you know this, you're a writer, gets so low, and what do you do when you take away all of the resources? How does that person resurrect him or herself? And I think about that in this story. Any other thoughts about what Jackie did?
Well, I love the whole pace and the metaphors and the senses of sound, scraping, sight, snow, using all the senses.
Right, and exactly. And she does use all the senses, and so descriptive. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. This is Hank Rubinchek with Nicole Rocherlin and my guest storyteller, Eric Hain. And you are listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9, excuse me, we're our friends in Huntsville. Elizabeth Ellis is a bona fide professional storyteller. She's written three books, one of which, Letting the Wolf In, Giving Yourself Permission to Tell Difficult Stories, co-authored with Lauren Niemi, who is also on this show, is a masterpiece. I attended her workshop when she was in Houston, and I was blown away. She showed us how to use our senses. Eric, you were just talking about how Jackie uses senses so well, and what Elizabeth does is I think she uses it better than anybody on the planet. It's hard to describe, but when we listen to her story, I think you'll see what I mean. But she communicates proximity and intensity and introspection. This story about a trip taken to Mississippi exposes, I think, her profound instincts. Nicole, let's listen to Elizabeth Ellis, please.
I was sitting in a booth in a Denny's in Columbus, Mississippi with my old friend Betsy Bishop. If you're ever homesick when you're out on the road, go to Denny's. You can pretend you're anywhere if you're at Denny's, because they all look alike. Even the waitresses all look alike at Denny's. Betsy held up the tourist brochure and she said, we've been to everything that's listed here except their historic cemetery. And I said, well, it seems a shame to leave Columbus, Mississippi without going to every site on their tourist brochure. After all, they printed it in color. So we went to the cemetery. Now, this was a cemetery that was made for the dead. We don't do that anymore. Mostly now we make cemeteries for the convenience of the living. If someone you love dies and you want to put a marker on their grave, you have to sink it in the ground for the convenience of the person who mows the lawn at the cemetery. But this was a cemetery that was old, when people still honored the dead with abandon. I was stunned by the different kinds of funeral statuary. They were everywhere. Couches and draperies made from granite or marble. Of course, there were depictions of Jesus. It was a southern cemetery. But the thing that struck my fancy were the angels. There were angels everywhere. There were angels kneeling, angels sitting, angels standing, angels dancing, angels flying, angels ascending. There were angels playing the harp. There were angels playing the trumpet. There were angels playing the drums. I was amazed to realize that heaven had a percussion section. That's a thought, you know. Betsy says to me, why don't you pick out one of these angels to be your angel and I'll pick out one to be my angel? I said, all right, we do that kind of thing. We walked a little bit further into the cemetery. I was looking at all those old-fashioned names on the stones. Finally, Betsy pointed to an angel and she said, that's my angel. It was a small angel sitting on the ground feeding a lamb. Looked just like Betsy. The angel, not the lamb. Betsy said, which one's yours? I said, I haven't seen it yet. We kept on walking. I thought that we were coming to the end of the cemetery. But I spotted her right in the middle of a family plot. Like a lot of southern cemeteries, it had a little white picket fence around the graves that belonged to that family. The family named Teasdale, like the American poet, but not her people. Right there in the middle of that plot on one grave was an angel who had thrown herself prostrate on the grave in her grief. It almost looked like her marble shoulders were shaking in sobs. It cut me like a knife. My mother hadn't been dead for very long. I said, Betsy, that's my angel. She said, looks just like you. I raised my eyes, thinking that I would be looking at the end of the cemetery, and instead I saw more graves in front of me than we had already walked past. But they didn't look like the ones we had walked by. These marched in rows of military precision, every single headstone exactly alike, spotless white marble. Even the inscription on the stones were exactly alike. Unknown Confederate dead. 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 Unknown. Till they disappeared completely out of sight. I looked to the left and was shocked to see an equal number of stones, these gray, the traditional domed shape. And as they marched across the brow of the hill, the inscription on every one of them said, unknown Union soldier, 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 till they disappeared out of sight. As I was trying to catch my breath, the caretaker of the cemetery came tootling up on his little three-wheel cart, and he asked us if we had found the grave that we were looking for, because he was just sure that we were involved in some kind of genealogy project. And we told him we weren't looking for any grave in particular. We just liked to go to cemeteries. And he gave us such a look. And he followed my line of sight, looking at all those matching gravestones, and he said, it's unbelievable, isn't it? I said, where did they come from? He said, well, you're standing in Mississippi, but you're just three stops down the train track from the Battle of Shiloh. I guess they buried all the men with names at the first two stops. I said, how many of them are there? He said, 55 acres. I couldn't draw in any breath. 55 acres. Of men without names who had died in the Battle of Shiloh. He said, you know, if you go home and you look on your computer, you can see that Memorial Day, it has a website. Everything's got a website these days. The website will probably tell you that some fancy Union general decided to start the idea of Memorial Day somewhere up north, I think 1868 or something. But we who live here in Columbus, Mississippi know that Memorial Day really started right here. Before the war was even over, the women of Columbus, Mississippi, came to decorate the graves of the glorious Confederate dead. And nobody remembers the name of the first woman who stepped forward and said, "But what about those boys over there? Their mothers are so far away." And so the women of Columbus, Mississippi went back to their gardens and they began to cut more flowers. They cut them by the wagon load, he said. And they didn't stop till they had decorated all those graves, all 55 acres. They decorated the graves of the men who might have caused the death of their husbands and sweethearts and brothers and sons. No matter what some fancy Union general says, Memorial Day started right here in Columbus, Mississippi. Said, "You know, this is my retirement job." Makes me laugh to think about that because I work so hard at it. I go home every day. I try to stay up late enough to watch the 10 o'clock news. What I see scares me. I watch the news. It seems like we can't even be civil to one another anymore. We can't even have a conversation with people whose opinions differ from our own. I watch the 10 o'clock news and come back here and look at all these graves for all the men with no names. And I wonder if it could ever come to that again. Could American blood ever be shed here on American soil by other Americans? I tell you, when I watch the news and I come back and look at these graves, it scares me. Scares me. You know, if it ever happens again, all I can hope for is that when all the fighting's over, someone will step forward and say, "But what about those poor boys? Their mothers are so far away."
What do you think? She's a real deal, isn't she?
Yeah, I've heard that before. I love it every time.
Yeah, it's there's something, I don't even know how to describe her storytelling style because it's so innate, it's so natural, and she's so engaging. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what always impresses me, and I hear the story so many times, and I don't want to bore people by playing the same story, but there are certain stories that make an indelible impression. You know, she's talking about the graves. Unknown Union soldier, unknown Union soldier, unknown soldier. And it's just a whisper. Mm-hmm. But,
you know, one of these quotes that I left out of here, but I recall, it said, a good storyteller makes you want to live in their story, and yeah. A great storyteller gives you no choice. I think in that story.
That is so true. I remember reading that right at your house, too. That is so appropriate. And she does that. She really does that. Mm-hmm. Nicole, Tatiana, what do you think of that story? You may have heard that before, but it's pretty incredible. What do you think?
I haven't heard it before, but it was interesting listening to. But it reminded me of how you were speaking when you had JJ's Girls on last week, when you were giving the lesson about the power of communication and when we're giving those purposeful pauses, how it creates the empathy or the emotion that we're trying.
Insight.
It sets the tone. And so that's what I really appreciated, because it just draws you in and you can tell how sincere she was about her story.
Like for example, honor the dead with abandon, that sort of stuff. Yeah, good insight. That's very, very true. Thank you. Very, very good. Great. Tatiana, what do you think?
I agree with Nicole, especially with her tone. Mm-hmm. It really sets the mood of the story, and the pauses, like how you mentioned last week. Mm-hmm. That does say a lot with the story. Yeah, it does, absolutely.
Like when she's talking about the graveyard, and it's so serious.
It's amazing. Well, you know, I'm not sure there are many that can get to Elizabeth Ellis status, but there are lots of ways to dip into the shallow end of the story pool. Right, Nicole?
That's right, Doc. But to start, everyone can fine-tune their storytelling skills by joining our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, at their monthly story swaps. Hey, they meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, and that's 1500 Sunset. So be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for all the upcoming events and for all of our past So What's Your Story programs, every show since 2008, listed right there on that menu under the radio program tab. Tatiana, tell me what else we need to know, girl.
Well, you're not hogging the script. Well, next is the Guild. Along with our program are the perfect steps to take if you want to build basic skills in storytelling. But another step is a stopover at Warehouse Live, where our friends at The Moth host their story event on the second Tuesday of the month. The Moth's Grand Slam is scheduled for May 2nd, as we said earlier in the show, and all the information can be found on Moth Houston. Warren will be one of the tellers that night, along with tonight's guest, Eric Heen, and eight other stellar tellers. We also want our listeners to know that not having a radio is no excuse for missing our program, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and Facebook Live.
Well, on top of that, do not forget to visit our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and most importantly, follow us and like us and tell your friends before you leave. And hey, we'd love to hear some feedback, guys.
Yeah, we would. We would. Nicole, and like we were talking about before the show, we're going to have to figure out something about May 2nd and what we're going to do about that. I don't know. It's kind of crazy. These great tellers only have 3 weeks to prepare, but we will figure something out. You know, last night was The Moth, and Paul Topekian, who's been on the show a couple of times, it was just a belly buster about walking into the ladies' room at the Charlotte airport. It had me laughing literally in my sleep. I was thinking about it all night. My wife thought I was out of my mind, even more so than usual. And the best piece of news that I want to save is this Friday is Tatiana's birthday. I mentioned it before, and we're going to mention it again. Where is she?
She was saying in the booth here, Doc, that she wanted you guys in the studio to get together and go ahead and harmonize and sing a happy birthday song to her on the air.
You want to do the da-da-da-da-da, I hear it's your birthday, or the traditional one?
A cappella for me.
Okay. Ready?
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday, dear Tatiana. Too many syllables. Happy birthday to you.
Oh, thank
you. All right. That was embarrassing, so we must really
love you. We're so glad you guys are storytellers.
That was so sick. Eric, in my mind, the wit that surrounds your next story is fueled by your meticulous sequencing of events. I'm a stickler with sequencing, and you do this so well. You know, some stories can survive the occasional detour, but not this one. I like to call it photo finish. I don't know if you gave it a title, but what do you think?
I call it a royal blush, but...
Royal blush. Photo finish, I don't know.
Okay, yeah, I'll play on words
right
there, but...
If you like it, don't give me credit. No one ever does. Go ahead.
I'll give you royalties. Okay, here
love
goes.
This one.
Fresh out of high school, I didn't have much ambition. I was going from job to job. But one day, I was reading in a comic book. And back in those days, comic books had these ads in the back. And a lot of times, there'd be an ad on these correspondence courses on how to learn a trade. And I saw this one, and it was on photography. And I knew it had to be a good one because it said, "You too can make big money as a photographer." So I saved up all my money. I bought an $80 Nikon camera, and I sent away for this correspondence course. About a week later, it came in the mail. I get all the material in, and when I finished that course that afternoon, I felt like I was ready to be a pro photographer. One problem. I lived in this tiny Montana farm town. The only thing to take pictures of were tractors and haystacks and livestock. But then my one big opportunity came up. See, my sister, she'd been attending this little college in Minnesota. And 2 days before she was to graduate, she called me and invited me to her graduation ceremony. I was just ready to tell her no, because I didn't want to drive 600 miles through the Dakota Badlands for that. But then she said the King of Norway, King Olaf, had been on this goodwill tour in that part of the country, and her school had booked the king to be the commencement speaker at her ceremony. And I thought, a real king? I could go get pictures of a real king. So I said, "Sis, I wouldn't miss your graduation for the world." Next morning, I get in my Ford Pinto. I drive the entire 600 miles in one day. I get to Moorhead, Minnesota at 3 in the morning. After a few hours of sleep in a cheap motel, I get up, I go out, and I find the auditorium. I go inside, and there, roped off, right in front of the stage, was this area designated for official photographers. I figured, I took the correspondence course, so I wander on down there, and I slip in under the rope. And I was hyped up. I mean, because I was surrounded by all these real photographers, all this expensive equipment, these cameras and tripods and microphones. But I also found out how competitive that business is. Because there's this wall of photographers right in front there getting all the good pictures. And I was back. I couldn't see a thing. But this was my one big chance, and I was not to be denied. So I wrestled, and I fought, and I squirmed, and elbowed my way. And I finally squeezed right to the front of that crowd. And I could see the whole stage. I could almost touch the stage. Then I realize, I don't know which one is the king. Thought he'd be wearing a crown or something. So I asked the guy next to me, I said, hey, he pointed out the king. It's this kind of short, heavy-set guy, sitting right in the middle. So I get out my camera, getting ready to take pictures. But there's this tall, lanky guy right in my line of sight there. So I wave my hands like crazy. I finally get the guy's attention, and I gesture very politely for the tall guy to step aside. And he did, and there, in all his glory, sat the king of Norway. So I just went crazy. I just went click, 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 click. I'd lean one way, lean the other way, just click, click, click. Stoop down, pop, pop, up. By the time I ran out of film, I had no doubt that I had some award-winning photos that'd probably be on the covers of magazines. Well, pretty soon the ceremony starts. College president gets up there. He talks for a while. Then he introduces the king. The king steps up to the podium. The tall, lanky king. The king whom I had just told to get out of my way so that I could take 124 pictures of the vice chair of the sociology department. I looked at that guy next to me, and I began to think of some creative ways of torturing him to death. But, you know, looking back on that day, I can't blame that guy. It was my own stupid fault. I violated the second rule of photography, and that is know thy subject. I should have known the king I didn't know. But I got to think, I did okay with the first rule of photography, and that's to have the ambition to go out there to begin with. Because look, I drove that 600 miles through the Badlands. I fought my way to the front of that crowd. And how many people can say that with one flick of their wrist, they cast a king aside?
Beautiful. All right. All right. Yeah. No one's watching your gestures in your face. And good. My God, I wish they could. God, I love that story. I do. I love all your stories, but some of these are just, they're just, I couldn't possibly create them in my mind unless I've heard them. That's how good they are. Because usually I can remember a story and retell it in some fashion or form. I can't do that with yours. But I do wonder about one thing. You know, North Dakota and South Dakota, do we need both Dakotas?
No.
I mean, they can't be that much different, can they?
No,
and... It just occurred to me. No. I don't know.
And East Montana, they call West Dakota.
So do they really?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Two Dakotas? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. This is Hank Rubicek, and you are listening and really enjoying this. What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, Pacifica Radio, fueled for peace. I'm your host, Hank Rubicek. The central element for solidifying a story is the story arc, which is a way to move a character or situation from one state to another. It's to effect change. And it's often accomplished by bringing a character to a low point, removing what she or he depends on, and then forcing the character to find new strength without those structures. It's difficult to build the arc in some shorter stories, but if done successfully, the results can be astounding. Now, a storytelling student at UHD told this story on this program on November 13th, 2013. Now, we talk about stories that we love and stories that we remember, and sometimes that adage is overused. But this is one of those stories that is remembered and cherished partly because of the amazing arcs that are positioned so skillfully within the story, and she didn't even know what she was doing in terms of these arcs. It's Katie Galloway's House of Pies. Nicole?
It was my 18th birthday, and all of my friends took me out to Chuy's Mexican Food Restaurant for the most delicious chicken fajitas. If you've never been there, shame on you. And we were so gorged, but of course, someone says, well, what are we having for dessert? Because no matter how much self-loathing is involved, you always have to have dessert. There's always space for that. So my best friend Greer says, oh, well, I have an idea, but you guys are just going to have to trust me on this one, which is always a bad idea. But we said, okay, we're 18, we're invincible, let's do it. So we go down Westheimer, and all of a sudden she says, okay, turn in here, it's House of Pies. And I turn in, and I was terrified. There was a homeless man on the sidewalk, and the building itself looked like it could just fall down at any moment when you open the door. And we thought, well, we'll trust her. So we walk in the front door, and I was hoping it would get better, and it just got worse. I felt like I had walked into a time warp. There were bacon and pancakes and fruit on the wallpaper, and the waitresses were dressed in these horrid maroon dresses with the hose and the grandma shoes and the smoker voices, and it just felt like I had stepped back in time to the 70s. And so I thought, oh, God, I'm going to die of food poisoning on my 18th birthday. This is so bad. And she said, just trust me. So we sit down, and there's this paper menu, and it has dozens of pies on it. And I'm just thinking to myself, I'm so indecisive, and I have no idea which one to choose. But then I thought, well, you can't mess up apple pie. So I get the apple pie, and it's warm, and the ice cream is on the side, and I think, okay, here goes. And I took a bite, and I knew in that moment that my life had changed, that this was special. And so the next weekend, I said, I have got to bring my brother, who was 16 at the time, Austin, and my little sister, Julie, who was 11, to House of Pies so that they could experience this with me. So I throw them in the car, and we get there, and they have pretty much the same exact response to it that I did. And they were terrified, and I said, just trust me, just trust me. So they fell in love with it just like I did on that very first night. And over that summer before I left for college, I tried to take them there a couple times a month at least and just really build that bond with them and make sure that they knew that I was always going to be their big sister, even though I was moving away, and that they could always count on me. And also the people watching there is indescribable, but there's just nothing quite like being there at 1 o'clock in the morning and watching a cougar with mascara running down her face trying to hit on some poor Joe Schmo over fried eggs, and the tweaker in the corner that you're not sure might shank you, and just bonding with all the servers that have such interesting life stories. And so we just really grew together. And and when I would come home from school for Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever, that was the first place we went. I would pick up Austin and Julie, and we would go to House of Pies and catch up and just have a good time. And we always kind of had this unspoken rule that that was our special place. We never took our parents, which I think they would have put the kibosh on it if they had seen it. And we never took friends. It was just the three of us. And so when Austin came to me one day and said, hey, I'd really like to bring my girlfriend, Catherine, he didn't admit it, but I knew that must mean she was special. And so I said, okay, sure, why not? And over that night at House of Pies, I knew that she was so important to him and that she was perfect for my baby brother. And so from then on, she was kind of in the gang, and when she could, she would come. And so then about 2 years later, I was at school in Dallas, and I was raped, and I was in the hospital for a couple of days, and I thought I could hack it at school, but I was having panic attacks, and I couldn't leave my apartment, and so I knew that I had to move home. And I asked my parents, please don't tell Austin and Julie, I want to tell them myself. And at the time, they were 18 and 14, and I knew that they could handle the truth, but I needed it to come from me. And so I got home and I said, hey, guys, we're going to House of Pies. And we got in the car and I didn't say anything about it until we got there. And when we sat down and we ordered our pie and I just told them everything. And they were crying and I was crying and we got our pie for free. And we just, in that moment, I realized that House of Pies was no longer just a special place for us, that it was a safe place, that it felt like coming home, that it felt like going to Grandma's house. It was just warm and special. And I moved home, and about 6 months after I moved home, my brother got very, very sick. He was born with cystic fibrosis. He was diagnosed with it as a baby, and that's a lung disease that has no cure, and the prognosis is not good. And he was in the hospital for about 3 months, and while he was in the hospital, I would take him House of Pies, and I would spend the night at the hospital to give my stepmom a break to get home, but also just to have fun and hope that he could feel like he wasn't in the hospital. And the nurses hated when I went there because we were so loud and always up to no good. And then finally we got the phone call one day that he was going to get a set of lungs and they were going to be perfect for him. And so we got the surgery, went through it with flying colors, and about a week later they sent him home. And of course, the first place we went was House of Pies. We packed up Catherine, and I packed up Julie and Austin, and we all went to House of Pies. And he got his Bayou Goo, which is gross, but that's his favorite. And we just had so much fun, and that night was perfect. It was perfect. And 3 years later, almost to the day, my brother got very, very sick again. And unfortunately, with lung transplants in particular, the immunosuppressive drugs really make it difficult to stay healthy for very long. And so he was sick again he was in the hospital for about a month. And one Sunday he called me and he said, Katie, I really want House of Pies, and can you just come hang out? And, you know, I was older by then and I had a full-time job. I was a restaurant manager working a million hours a week. And I just said, Austin, you're gonna have to get over yourself. Stop being such a baby. I have work in the morning. And I hung up with him, and the next morning I got a call saying that he had taken a turn for the worse overnight. My dad told me that he was now too sick to get a transplant, which unfortunately is a very narrow line to walk. You have to be sick enough to need a new organ, but if you're too sick, they don't think you'll survive the surgery, and so they won't do it. And at that point, we knew that it was just a matter of time. And he was no longer lucid. They had amped up the pain medication so that he wasn't in pain. And so then on Thursday morning, my brother passed away. And the last thing I ever said to him was, stop being such a baby. And so that night, I packed up Catherine and Julie, and we went to House of Pies, and we cried, and we ate Bayou Goo, even though he was the only one that liked it. And we just remembered Austin. And I took one of those ugly 70s-tastic paper menus, and I took it home, and I wrote a note to my baby brother, and I said all of my hopes and dreams, and I tried to come up with a plan on how I would fill that void of him and our family. And I folded it up, and I put it in his casket, and I buried it with him. And 3 months after my brother passed away, I found out I was pregnant with the baby that I was told I couldn't have because of complications from the rape. And in that moment, I knew that this miracle was my brother's miracle, that this baby was my very own Austin. And now I look forward to the day when I can have a special place, my own House of Pies, with my very own little Austin.
See what I'm saying? Just all over the place.
It's incredible, yeah. So she expresses relationships with her. Everyone.
Yes.
It's really deep.
Yeah. I mean, saving a menu from House of Pies, like any item thrown in our memorabilia boxes, can ignite wonderful stories, and that's what she did. Mm-hmm. She had the menu, and that's what ignited that story. In Katie's, the thread seamlessly taking us from one tragedy to another, each somehow making sense of the heartbreak that preceded it. And, you know, I just thought about the arcs. The story of our lives don't always tickle. Katie's story, and so many told by this eclectic community, reminds me of these moving words by John Steinbeck, and Eric, I think you'll like this quote. Mm-hmm. We are all lonesome animals. We spend all of our time trying to be less lonesome. One of our ancient methods is to tell a story begging the listener to say and feel, yes, that's the way it is. Or at least, that's the way I feel it. You are not alone as you thought.
Love it.
Timing, imagery, use of senses, and finding the arc. Four mindful features on which tellers must embark. A little ditty for tonight's journey to the Twilight Zone. You ever watch that show?
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, that's something that he would say. Thank you, Eric Heen, for still another night of fun and frolic in Storyland. And thank you to Jackie Great. Ford, Katie Holloway, and Elizabeth Ellis for helping to make tonight another special event. And it's always special when storytellers is the cast of characters. Next week, Gregor's going to be on tap to host this, the only storytelling show to originate from Houston. We're going to change up our outro tonight, play the perfect song for tonight. So listen to these magical lyrics to the story, Brandi Carlile. Don't you dare move, because Wild Bill and the Vital Avenger, that animated duo, are up next with cool classics for the cooler you. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story, and treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Dr. Hank, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. I was made for you. I climbed across the mountain tops. Swam all across.
Don't miss the pinnacle of the 31st Annual Houston Art Car Parade Weekend, the Houston Art Car Parade. 250-plus jaw-dropping mobile masterpieces take to the streets Saturday, April 14th at 2 p.m. in an inimitable display of razzle-dazzle. And be sure to check out KPFT's very own 1977 C10 Sidestep Street Rod, slated at number 197 in the lineup. This year's parade moves back to Allen Parkway. Beverage booths, food trucks, and more. And as always, the parade is free and family-friendly. For more information and grandstand seating, visit the HoustonArtCarParade.com. Sponsored in part by KPFT Houston. Get even more from your KPFT listening experience by checking out our HD2 stream. New and improved, get acquainted with our revamped weekly schedule now at kpft.org. Fear not. Nationally syndicated favorites like Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Letters in Politics, and Economic Update remain. And good news, our evening schedule now features more local shows, including a stellar mix of public affairs, music, comedy, and Spanish language programming created and produced right here at KPFT. Don't miss a second on HD2. Mouse on over to kpft.org or on TuneIn Radio today. KPFT, Houston.